Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
We at Pack Your Knives love to draft, so much so that we decided to draft Top Chef contestants live on the podcast. Drafting is the best, and if you're into fantasy sports, I got a stat for you. Did you know that your chances of winning on draft are 80% better than on salary cap sites? That's why Draft is my favorite fantasy site. No more getting crushed by the pros. And it's not just me. More than 1 million people that have already downloaded Draft 2. Play in a real live NBA draft right now and be done in under 5 minutes. Get paid out the very next day. Drafts are filling every second, so you can join one whenever you want. All new players get a free entry into a real money draft when you make your first deposit. But make sure to use my promo code HEALTHY. H-E-A-L-T-H-Y. HEALTHY. That's right, play in a real money draft for free just by using my promo code HEALTHY. But it gets even better. Draft is so sure you'll love it that they're even offering Pack Your Knives listeners a money-back guarantee of up to $100. Just search Draft in your app store or go to draft.com and play free right now with promo code HEALTHY. I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, Restaurant Wars.
Yes.
This is the great mid-season tournament that we all want and love, and this is what we all tune in for.
Look, man, we have in the NBA the All-Star Week, the All-Star Break. It doesn't hold a candle to Restaurant Wars as a mid-season tournament, a mid-season spectacle. I think this is the best episode of the entire season. Not talking about this season, but in general, Top Chef, this is my favorite part of the show.
It's a lot happened, but not a lot happened. On one hand, boy, do I love Restaurant Wars. And this was a great episode, and there was a lot of tension. But I got to say, pretty smooth relative to Restaurant Wars. Like, no interpersonal craziness until the chopping block. No real point of crises. I think the losing team in any other season would have looked like the fair-haired child who had their act together.
Yeah, I really felt the same way, where I think the editing team for Bravo, I think they had to search for some real drama where you kind of felt like, oh, this is a tire fire. Usually that happens on Restaurant Wars. In fact, there's usually both teams having a dumpster fire during Restaurant Wars. It never happens that both squads came out firing. And look, your team is really hurting right now. Your team is really
taking on water. Yes, we are.
You are taking on water, but we got Big Joe Flam. You got saved by Big Joe Flam, who just absolutely blew this competition out of the water. You know, Tom Colicchio was very surprised that Joe Flam had the personality to be the rock star on front of house. I'm surprised by that. I feel like all season,
he's like this big Midwestern lug who can't charm people or doesn't have enough stage presence to man the front of the house.
Yeah, and when he got selected, I think Tom was like very surprised by that, but I wasn't surprised at that because he has a lot of charm. He's a big bear. He's really funny. He's got great wit.
And by the way, his work in really busy major big city restaurants. Like, never underestimate the value of experience in Restaurant Wars for the restaurant. We've seen the kind of one-off chef or the private chef or the younger chef wilt in past years, and I think there's a real value in just basically you've been in essentially NBA arenas your entire career, like major restaurants with large table counts and big chefs and big demands and high ticket prices, which means diners who are expecting an absolutely transcendent experience. And I think that really helps.
Yeah, it does. And Joe is one of the big high scorers of our fantasy league right now. Your team right now is checked in at a total of 126 points. You had 12 points this week, buoyed by Joseph's 20 points this week for winning the elimination challenge from front of house. Then you have -3 for Fatima, and that's the first time she's been in the bottom the whole entire season. Welcome to the bottom, yep. Fatima. Special
we
guest.
We will be talking. Can we tease? We will be talking to Chef Fatima Ali very shortly.
Yes, I'm so excited for that. And Claudette was she packed her knives and went. And interestingly enough, Kevin did not give any hugs or kisses or any sort of embraces when she got voted off.
The walk-off, pack your knife. So let's back up for one second. I want to first start with they picked teams. So they drew knives, and Carrie having the first pick. They picked teams, and I wasn't surprised at all with the order. I thought it made a lot of sense, right? Carrie has first pick, goes immediately for Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Kalman, who has run a beard-dominated restaurant, is an executive chef, has been doing it for years, is, by the way, at the top of his game right now, just in terms of sheer execution and vision. Yep. Easy first pick. Chris comes back, picks Joe Sash, right?
Yeah, another juggernaut. Both on my team, by the way.
Right. Figure that, hey, Joe Sash is the most creative cook right now in the kitchen, and do that. They come back, and Fatima is, am I correct? Is Fatima
no,
the next
Joe Flam.
Joe Flam. You know, that was, you know, right. Joe Flam, Fatima, that's a pick'em in my book. But Joe Flam, again, big city restaurants, whatever. Fatima's a great second pick. And then Adrian is sort of the first or the last pick. By the way, Adrian is kind of a really good Restaurant War contestant. She is a master prep, is good in knife skills. And then you saw, hey, that duck was cooked perfectly. Like, you need 100 portions of a protein cooked really well in terms of temperature.
Yep. Adrian's my LeBron in that point. Yep.
She's got a lot of technique, a lot of fundamentals, kind of the perfect teammate.
Yes.
For this challenge. And then you had Claudette, who, to nobody's surprise, was the last pick, probably largely not due to anything food-wise as much as has demonstrated herself to be a little less than a team player.
And granted, Kevin, she said on our podcast that she didn't grow close to anyone on the show.
Right.
So we don't have to kind of beat around the bush here. She wasn't feeling part of the group. And in Top Chef, that matters.
Yes, and I think her final words in her elimination testimonial were that if Top Chef are looking for a vanilla Top Chef, they are doing an excellent job.
Thumbs up.
Which, by the way, I got to say. And now, listen, she's also came on the show and basically said, look, trash talking is kind of part of the fun here.
Yes.
She's doing a little Joel Embiid. I mean, she's very aware of the trash talk. I think she has legitimate respect for these people and their talents. No but doubt. It doesn't sound like it.
You know, she on the show, like in the kitchen, she was very much the anti-shade queen. She was the shade queen in the testimonials and the confessionals, right? But then on the show, she's like, no mean people here, all happy, happy, happy. And I always felt that was a really weird contrast. It was like, I think she was trying to project in the kitchen that everything's happy, everyone's friends, everyone's great, and trying to be kumbaya in the kitchen. And then afterwards, I mean, she was just killing people.
Well, I would say this. I actually think – so the part of me felt like a little bit of this episode was that meme with the dog sitting and saying this is fine in the fire, because there are all these observations that, hey, they felt like things were going really well. Now, on the other hand, I think things were going comparatively really well. I think most years that is a successful restaurant war performance. You put that up against, I'd say, of the previous 28 – there was no restaurant war one season. So for the previous 26 restaurant war teams, where do you think that performance gets ranked?
I mean, pretty high.
I would say like top eight, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here are the stats.
And so, no lower than 500, right? I mean, no lower than 12.
Right. There's a great site called TopChefStats.com. I don't know if you've stumbled upon it.
Well,
I just figured this out.
Wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
TopChefStats.com.
I think, yeah, it's
Who is this person?
We're going to have to get her on the show. She's compiled all sorts of infographics. I just got onto this.
Oh my goodness, look at this with the color-coded chef coats and like the real and the floating heads.
It's everything I would want a site. It's as if like she made the site that I want.
Oh.
So, the
proprietor of – hold on. You, the proprietor of Top Chef Stats, please get in touch.
Hey, look. This is an amazing stat. So 50% of the staff on Restaurant Wars is front of house or executive chef, right? Two out of the four people. But it is responsible for 72% of the winners and losers. So Claudette called it the bad juju. She said if you're an executive chef, you're either going to win or you're going to lose. And typically you're going to lose. And she didn't want any of that bad juju, but that was prophetic. Most of the people that get the front of house or executive chef, they're either winning or they're going home. And in this case, we had both of those instances come true.
Let me give you my conspiracy theory. Not a conspiracy theory, but a theory nonetheless that is implicitly a conspiracy. Do you think the red team commonplace – we're setting Claudette up.
Oh, 100%. Okay. 100%.
So there's sink or swim. Hey, win-win for all of us. Either we all win and terrific and bravo, no pun intended, and we all move on and Claudette does a great job. But if it so happened that we don't win, well, I'm a line chef.
Exactly.
Hello, Chris. Well, I'm, you know, doing some other stuff over here. I'm just having to execute my three dishes, which he actually did, interestingly enough. I mean, that was sort of the, you know, I think if you're Joe Stash coming into that situation, you look around, you see your buds on the other team, you figure you're a morning underdog. Okay, so now what? Well, you know one thing, you can cook your ass off. So what do? You make sure you avoid front of the house. You make sure you avoid executive chef. And boom, you end up as a line cook. You execute at least two of your three dishes well, hopefully all three, never fewer than one. Now, and that's how you get out of this jam. And hey, look, if it just so happened that you win, you win. But so that was a setup.
Yeah, I think that was a setup. And look at the dynamic there at the end when they're on the chopping block and Chris jumps on the grenade and just says, look, I was the team leader, which I think is arbitrary. He picked the knife. I don't think that means that he's the quote-unquote leader, even though he's the – what do you think about that? Do you think Chris Like, Carrie, I don't think, was seen as the leader on that team, even though she arbitrarily picked the knife.
I think Chris played that brilliantly.
I did, too.
I think Chris has crafted this aw shucks persona. But he is the wiliest motherfucker in the show. Dude. That is what I think. And I am sorry I traded him. And I am having huge buyer's remorse. I feel like I dealt for Aaron Aflalo and gave away Will Barton in a first. And I'm telling you right now, Tom, like this whole thing last week of, I don't know what's going on. You know, this whole way. Like he knew he would take responsibility and he knew that Fatima and everybody else would say, this man has so much integrity.
Yep.
He's just doing this to because this is the kind of guy he is. He's three steps ahead. Like he's doing the I'm from small town Pennsylvania. He knows exactly what he is fucking doing. And yeah.
Like if there was a side conversation or a secret meeting between Fatima, Joe Stash, and Christopher, I would be not surprised at all. Like I at the end of this episode, it became very clear that if it wasn't intentional scheming, it was very much subconscious scheming. Because as soon as Chris fell on that grenade and said, "Look, this is my team. I'm gonna own it. All this." Fatih just comes in, rescues Chris, and then it looks like it's totally innocent, right? That all of them are all just noble in this, just to like be honest. But it seems like to me this was a setup on Claudette, and Claudette could sense it, and she just went out in a ball of scorn by not hugging anybody on her way out. It was an amazing social dynamic there at the end.
Let's bring in Hershey Ash.
Well, first, can I just rub some salt in the wound real quick? I am up 132 to 126. I had a big week, 24 to 12, Kevin. You have two chefs still in the competition. We're not talking about Lance Chance competition. You have Fatih and Joe Flam, and then I have five chefs. So you lose one of them in Claudette, and I made the trade for Christopher. But interestingly enough, in our scoring system, Kevin, Claudette has -5 since she joined your team, and Christopher is -6. So I actually have bled more with Christopher so far than you have with Claudette. And it's second to Last Chance Kitchen for Claudette. She's back in Last Chance Kitchen. But right now, Kevin, I've taken the lead in our fantasy squads.
Okay, and then this is not good for me. I do – well, you've allayed some of my fears, which is that I basically traded – Pedro Martinez for Jelino to Shields, but we will find out.
Yes.
I want to bring in Hershey Ash, a good friend of mine who is essentially a restaurant consultant. You bring him in as a fixer when you're opening a place up or you want to overhaul a place managerially or whatnot. And going to a restaurant with him is like going with Hubie Brown and watching a game. Like he can tell you everything that's going on. So I want to bring him in here. Tom, I'm going to call him up.
Let's do it.
Here we go.
Really excited for this guy.
We are joined by Hershey Ash. So, like, Hersh, you're my friend, but just explain to the good people in brief what it is you do for a living and why you're here for Restaurant Wars.
Sure. So, I'm what they call a restaurant consultant, which is just a dirty word in my mind. So really, consultant is sometimes a fancy word for being unemployed. So in my case, what it means is people hire me to either open up or fix up restaurants for them. So what does that mean? So generally, mainly do openings, and that can be anything. That could be sometimes I come on board and, you know, some property developers have bought a 100-year-old bank and they're like, we need to gut this and turn it into a restaurant. And sometimes it'll be folks that are a week away from opening and they're freaking out and, you know, they need a little bit of help to straighten out. But generally speaking, it's people who you know, come on, you know, a couple of months beforehand and have some structure in place and they're looking for me for help with strategic advice and certainly, you know, to parlay my experience, I guess, in done quite a few openings.
So you're like a professional restaurant warrior. You're a restaurant mercenary. So
that's right.
Well, let's jump into it. You watched Restaurant Wars last night. We're recording this on Friday morning. Give us your X's and O's. You were Hubie Brown. You were Brent Berry. You were any of the analysts that you would enjoy on an NBA game. And I want to know the X's and O's. I want to know, like, did they execute the keys to the game? What did you see that we might not have seen? All right,
let me give a very pointed question here. When you heard that Commonplace was going to be the name of the restaurant without a real backbone or theme to the restaurant, was that just a giant red flag where you say, oh boy, here we go?
So the short answer is yes. The long answer is I wrote down here in my notes when I saw that these guys have lost. but I want to give you a little brief intro. And this is something that I meant to tell Kevin when you first mentioned that you guys are doing the podcast, but I've managed to save it for now. I want to give you the difference between a chef and a cook, because I think this is really, really important to this show, the actual Top Chef, and to understand what we talk about. So a cook, let's explain a cook first. A cook is someone who can put a lot of flavors together, which is really important. They understand, you know, the combination of flavors. A cook sort of person comes over to your house and says, yeah, you've got plenty of stuff in the cupboard. I'll just make this work and taste good. A cook is also someone who is able to work in a professional kitchen. A cook is someone who, you know, it's a Saturday night, two people have called in sick, and a cook is the person who stands up, goes, I've got this. It's okay. I'll make this work. Don't worry. It'll be great. That's a cook, which is a really important role. But a chef is something else altogether. A chef is someone who can run a professional kitchen, and a chef is someone who realizes that. What does that mean to run a professional kitchen? This is a business. This business needs to be successful. There are many, many people who are relying on this business to be successful for their income, to pay their bills. And a chef is someone who has the holistic ability to operate a business, which is something else completely different. Now, when we're hiring, we want to hire a chef. We need to hire chefs that are in charge. In a perfect world, you'd get a chef who has the ability to be a cook, but it's less important.
Are you able to see the chefs and the cooks on the kitchen in this show?
It takes a second.
All right. Wow. Who are the chefs and who are the cooks?
The young lady who got kicked off last night, her name is
Claudette.
Okay, so she is not a chef. And listen, she seems like a lovely lady and she's supporting her family and I hope her business does well. And I'm not saying that disingenuously. I really mean that. But she is not a chef. She does not have the ability.
Now, she's not a chef yet. She's a young, possibly still green, doesn't know what it really means, kind of in her first rookie contract. But she will, like, a cook can become a chef.
So she is going to – and listen, I feel like I'm going to mention him later as well. I feel like I'm picking on him. But she is Jahlil Okafor, which is – she is what she is, and she's never going to change, right?
No, but Jahlil Okafor is in the NBA, okay? Jahlil Okafor is making millions in the NBA.
Okay, and she might be doing very, very well and paying for her family and doing well out of her business. I really hope so. But I can tell you the game has passed Ja by and the game has passed her by. Look, internally, there's a few problems with her. First of all, her throwing under the bus thing, which we've seen her do on 3 or 4 episodes now, that is not a chef. A chef is a person who stands up and says, I'm in charge here. This is my responsibility for my team, for me. I'm wearing this. That's something we've seen her not do 3 times. I also think the fact that she does really well in these last chance kitchens and why she comes back is because she's a cook. Last chance kitchens are, you know, just cooking, and, you know, which is great. She makes the food, it tastes good. But she does not inspire leadership. She doesn't inspire confidence. And I can tell you the thing she said last night where she said, yeah, I'm going to expo and I'm just going to let people do what they do. If I've sat in numerous amounts of interviews with chefs to hire, and I know many people who hire. If anyone said that in an interview to anyone I know or myself, that person would never get a second call back for an interview. Forget about it. If they told you their style was, yeah, just sit back and let them do what they'll do, forget about it. You're like, right, this person's not a chef.
Go back to Tom's question, though, the commonplace.
Commonplace. Okay,
what's wrong with it?
Okay, so let me tell you a thing that I tell restaurant owners all the time. The best kind of restaurant you could open, and this is an analog, but the best kind of restaurant you can open is a Thai restaurant. Why? Because when people say, what sort of restaurant is it? You say, it's Thai. And then that person knows, when I want sweet and sour or spicy or flavors, I'm going to go to that restaurant. Now, that doesn't tell you if it's fancy or it's a takeaway or this or that, but that's not really how the general public people process a restaurant. They process it by what flavors am I going to expect? So what they did was an inverted thing. They said, let's come up with a name and then we'll cook to the name. It doesn't make any sense. Here's my second, you know, mention of poor Jar. But imagine, here's the basketball analog. Imagine sitting around in the coaches' rooms and you're saying, cool, you know what we're going to do? We're going to run 7 seconds or less. We're going to rebound and sprint and shoot transition threes. And then you go into your locker room and tell Rajon Rondo and Jahlil Okafor, cool, we're running 7 seconds or less. It doesn't make any sense. You should coach towards the team that you have. You should set up a restaurant towards the team you have. So my advice to them would have been, look, you guys need to present to the judges uniform restaurant. I think from watching the episodes, you all seem to be okay at cooking vegetarian or non-meat dishes. You know, Mustache Joe is really good with the vegetarian pastas. The rest of the guys have done some really interesting things with their accompaniments. So they seem to have a skill with vegetables. I'm not a massive fan of vegetarian restaurants, but that would have been a brilliant thing to just say, cool, we're a vegetarian restaurant. Every dish is vegetarian. And then the judges would have gone, this makes sense to me. This is a vegetarian restaurant. Simple.
Yeah,
that would have been my professional advice.
Because commonplace, the theme of that restaurant was there's no theme. Right off the bat, I think it was Gail or someone said at the judges table exactly what I was thinking, which is Conifer had a distinct plan. They had a theme. They had everything lined up, and you could feel it. I mean, you could see it from the way you walked into the room to the plating to the menu, everything. And Padma said it was the best menu she's seen on Top Chef. But commonplace, I think it was a collective understanding that, like, you know what, we're just half-assing this.
Yeah, and it felt really disparate and disconnected, which is obviously what she was saying. I think, look, with the other guys with Conifer, I'm going to be real honest here. I didn't really understand how that was Colorado. I don't. There was seafood on the menu. I feel like I'm missing something here. There was state sea bass on the menu, didn't they?
Yes.
Colorado, well, rainbow, I think it was, but that's freshwater fish.
Was it? Oh, okay, so my fault. I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
I could be wrong, but I think that was a freshwater fish.
Adrian's?
Was it trout or what was it? Bass?
It was sea bass.
It was sea bass. It was the Colorado sea bass.
Sea bass. Never mind. I take it back. Okay.
It was sea bass. Yeah. So is there sea bass in a landlocked state?
I just was wondering the same thing. She said it was a Carolina sea bass, but that can't be right.
Yeah. So to me, I had questions about that. I mean, I'm going to give you my favorite moment, this note. And we've been kind of laughing about this in the office. I'm on a job here in Austin at the moment. We were laughing about this morning. Bruce, who Kevin would know, you know, I've done some jobs in the neighborhood where Union is. So we have some mutual friends. Said one of the greatest, most ridiculous buzzword things I've ever heard in my life when he was telling the people setting up the restaurant, yes, we're an ingredient-driven restaurant.
Yeah.
No idea what that means. I've been thinking about that all morning, and I'm trying to think of a restaurant that isn't ingredient-driven, and I cannot come up with one.
Bubblegum shrimp. Yeah.
Are you oxygen-driven?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Like, I don't.
Hooters.
Hooters. Hooters is still ingredient driven. They sell. We take chicken wings. That's the ingredient.
I think it's driven by something else by the title. But anyway. But yeah, there was a distinct lack of clarity from commonplace, and we did. And Hershey, you're an NBA fan, so you appreciated that there was a Phil Jackson reference here. But they actually said he was from LA. And he was an LA guy, but at the time when they were taping, it was May, and he was the president of the New York Knicks. And how do they screw that up? But I appreciate that, Chris. I love the NBA shout out.
I mean, I wrote when he mentioned that the Phil Jackson mention is a bad omen because
I'm Phil Jackson here, and the Phil Jackson of this era is not the Phil Jackson of the Chicago Bulls era.
Correct. So that
also Hershey is one of the biggest San Antonio Spurs fans I've met.
Tragic nerd. So, you know, we see basketball differently to people like that.
You know, it was interesting. I wanted to ask you, tasting as you go as a concept. I mean, that seems, at least from Gail Simmons' perspective, that's a big thing. That is a mandatory thing.
So if we're judging chefs, if we're, you know, looking in the kitchen trying to see the performance, if they're not tasting as they go, that becomes an enormous red flag. And Bruce did mention it, that he saw it as well. It's an enormous red flag because it tells us one of two things are happening. Either you're so under the pump, you're so in the weeds that you're not executing correctly, or you haven't been trained properly. And if you're not trained properly, you're probably going to fall down in a whole bunch of other places. But the notion of not tasting your food that you send out, you don't have to be in a restaurant to know why that would be a terrible idea to not do that.
And manage the past. How does an executive chef manage the past?
I don't even know what that is.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. This is a good question. So essentially, if you imagine they're doing a three-course menu. Okay.
Just to get background, hold on one second, Hershey. Bruce took it upon himself to kind of manage the past in addition to being executive chef, or maybe that just goes one and the same. It's the moment, what, Hershey, that the plate passes from the kitchen to the wait staff.
Yeah, but it's a bit more than that, because what it is it's sometimes called expoing or calling the past, which is probably a better way to put it. So if you imagine they've got 10 tables, and this table's on first course, and this table's on second course, and the tables that are on the second course, there's two bass, but I need one now, and I need one in 2 minutes, and I need this in 5 minutes, and I need that. It's making it work and all together. So calling the past is not simply just passing the food, but it's saying, hey guys, I need three bass now, and then in 2 minutes I'm going to need this. And it's not just saying it once, it's staying on top of it. So checking in, hey, I said that I need a bass in a minute. Are you up to date with that? So it's staying on top of that. It's a very, very, very difficult thing. It requires a lot of mental organization and ability to really remember things as you go. And if you do that, your chefs just have the ability to just cook. Just, okay, I'm making five fish. That's it. Just make that. I can call that. And this guy or this girl who's calling the pass has the ability to make sure I'm going to put plates up at the same time. It's a very, very difficult thing to imagine when you're in a room with, let's say, 20 tables. You can't just send dishes willy-nilly, you know. All four dishes for this table have to line up with the other dishes from this table. So that's the real skill of it.
Hey, Hershey, on a night that Fatima encountered where the early diners are lingering, and it might even be a good thing. It might be they're enjoying their time in your space. This is a good thing, yet now the flow is backing up. Like, is there a polite way to kick people out of tables to get your night back on schedule?
I'm going to tell you a story because I guess you want a story. I cannot tell you the restaurant because this is selling them down the river, but this would be – it's no longer open. It's one of the top restaurants in Australia, in Australian history. And my dear friend used to – this we're talking about $500, $600 a head restaurant. And I guess he's going to give it away to some people. Friend used to walk around to the tables at 11 o'clock at night that had dropped an enormous amount of money and who were lingering and not leaving. And he'd lean over very politely. He's a very tall man and say, I'm just letting you know, I accidentally called an extra taxi. If you need one, let me know before I let them go. Mm. So there's little tricks like that, which are, you know, in the borderline.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, that's bold. That's some
that really
stuff.
Is bull. And
but what about like at 8:30? Like in
yeah. So the skills that we have, especially in modern restaurants, we have bars. So what we'll often do is if we really need a table back, and they definitely could have and should have 100% done this because they had the room. We'll say, look, look. Do you mind if I were to move you up to the bar? I'll buy you a free drink on me, and you can sit there and enjoy. And a lot of times tables come up with it. That's a worst case scenario. To tell you the truth, what you're really trying to do is there are times, you know, and this they wouldn't have known because they weren't able to operate like this, but there are times up a restaurant, a diner is at the beginning of the meal. So the quicker you get the order in, the quicker you get the first course down, these are times you can shave. Once they're finished, there's nothing really left to shave. So the correct play was the winning team, even though Bruce pushed back on this, but large Joe or non-mustache Joe did the right thing of getting people in quickly and getting their orders quickly. That was the right thing to do because you can save time then.
Hershey, this has been invaluable. This is great.
Yeah.
I need to come to Austin.
Yeah, please. Guild restaurant in the Austin area. You got to come and check us out.
All right, so you said Hershey that Claudette may not have been a chef, but if you're opening up a restaurant and you just had your pick of the litter here of all the chefs that you've seen on Top Chef on this season or last night, who is your number one pick?
It's Joe. Joe won last night, didn't he?
Joe Flam or yeah. Joe Stash?
Joe Flam. Joe Stash would be interesting. I feel like you'd have to get him in and what did someone say? Get the 20s off him? Is that what it is? Bash the 20s out of him? He'd be interesting. But it's definitely the Joe that won last night. I would hire him. I wouldn't – like tomorrow morning.
No way.
That guy is the real deal. That guy in terms of a chef. Without tasting his food, that's a gentleman that has the ability to – operate a business, which is what we're doing. If you saw last night, he did a whole bunch of really, really interesting things. There was a moment they showed, and I know this is selective editing, but a table left and he said, oh, I'd love you to meet you. Thank you. Thank you. That's a guy that's going around and touching tables. You know, that's a term Tom used when describing it. And that's exactly it. To me, that's a human being that understands what we're doing. We're not selling food. We're not providing service. We are providing hospitality. Oh. And that's a man that had the ability to do that.
How good was that little moment on the show last night when Padma was like, you know, Danny Meyer just said he once told me that the food is what you come to the restaurant for, but it's the hospitality that you come back for. And it was like, no, that was me.
Let me give you a little to understand why Tom was extra wounded about it. Danny Meyer, on our side, what we do, you know, in the consulting and the thing, Danny Meyer is the most ridiculously overquoted source for stuff. The amount of stuff that's attributed to him.
He's the Yogi Berra.
Yeah. And listen, it's we're in backlash to the backlash stage now because there's been the backlash and now it's cool to like him again. So I think that's why Tom was pushing back. I think Tom's sick of hearing Danny quotes over the years. I mean, there are people in this industry who can quote Danny's books in its entirety to you ad nauseum. So,
That was so good. And Raisin Beats. Shout out to Raisin Beets.
Raisin Beets. What did she call it? Adult jelly babies. Or adult jelly, yeah.
Adult gummy bears.
Gummy bears. There you go. Which I think in the great state of California means something. Well, no, actually, the same state of Colorado as well. So she should be careful saying that.
This was awesome. I thought this was an excellent episode. I thought it was, of all Restaurant Wars episodes, Hershey, this was very smooth. There wasn't a total disaster in the kitchen. And that's a very big rarity. I wanted to relay this story real quick. In Miami, Yardbird opened up. And Yardbird is this Southern comfort food that was opened up by Jeff McGinnis, who's a former Top Chef. And on the first night, my wife and I, we went to the opening, and it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. Yardbird went off to great success. Actually, a couple of Top Chefs went through there as the executive chef. But the first night, they had those like computer, little handheld computer menu things where like the servers were like, what would you like? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to have the meatloaf, and then I'm going to also have the fried chicken. And she has the little the pen and the stylus, and she's putting in the order in. And this was like 5 years ago, and I'd never seen one of these little handheld computers with the server, and it was a total outright disaster. The wrong food to the wrong tables. And at one point, the server, when our guest, our friend Mary, was she asked for wine. No, my wife asked for the wine, and she asked for a glass of wine, and the server came by and gave her a carafe of full wine. And my wife said, hi, can I please have a glass? And the server says, no, I just talked to the chef. That's how he'd like to serve it.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, in the carafe? And so the other server to the table next to us overheard this. And the good Samaritan server that he was, he says, I will get you a glass, ma'am. Sorry, that is our mistake. And the server, the next week when we came back, that same server for our table, she was working as a busboy. Or whatever you want, bus person. So she definitely got demoted after that night. But the whole idea of serving someone a carafe of wine and not expecting them to drink out of that, it was a very first night opening restaurant move. And it was – last night's Restaurant Wars wasn't quite that. I was surprised at how well it went.
So first of all, I agree. That was in my notes. I was like, wow, I was expecting more drama, more to talk about today. But they went pretty smooth. I will say, to tie your story just now through to what that episode – it sounds like to me what went wrong is some of the same things that went wrong last night, which is there's a certain skill to running a restaurant that's not as a holistic thing, running the front of the house. That's not necessarily in the wheelhouse of every chef and doesn't really need to be. You can be a really successful chef and have someone operate the front of the house for you. So I don't know how effective this challenge is. Maybe I'm a bit controversial, but I don't know how effective this challenge is in finding out a chef, but you could see a lot of the failures for the team that lost. You know, there was a mention made at one point, wow, she doesn't seem to be interacting, Fatima, it doesn't seem to be interacting with customers. She seems to be interacting with servers. And that's very much a chef thing. There are no customers. So a head chef or an executive chef in a kitchen is very much interacting only with their staff to use the staff as the tool to make it work. And she essentially ran the floor as she would have run the kitchen.
Right.
And I don't know how many points you should be taken off of for that because the show is Top Chef.
Well, Hershey, here's my question though, because I think Fati made a strategic decision there. Was I would rather have the diners go, like, if I'm going to choose between the servers going down in flames or the diners feeling like they weren't being touched, which one would you pick there? Because Fatima established pretty early that these servers are not up to par. They are the G League and I need some NBA squads, right? And so she spent most of her time making sure that the servers went okay, because if the servers went down, then the whole thing collapses, right? But if she doesn't touch every single table, I mean, if you're going to pick between two evils, which one would you pick?
So it's not even – there's no choice. I mean, it's simple. You pick the hospitality. First of all, I'm sure Joe got the same quality staff that she got. She just chose to focus on the wrong thing. He chose to focus on the right thing. There's no way they got a pool of servers and he just happened to get all the experts and she got all the non-experts. I'm sure they were the same quality. The reality is that we in a restaurant, we don't sell servers. We don't sell food. That's not what we do. We sell hospitality.
Wow.
So if you're focusing on the service and you're focusing on the food to the detriment of hospitality, if you can focus on all three, that's Great. That's the ultimate goal. But her focus on the service does show me a red flag of that. If I hire this person as a chef, are they going to be so focused on the food itself that they're going to lose the ability to recognize that we are selling hospitality here? And that's when you ask me who would I hire, that's why it would be Joe in a moment. Because that gentleman identified right away, I'm sure he had the same quality staff. But he worked out, look, these are people, let's be realistic what this is. This is not a real restaurant. These are people coming in. They want to be part of a television show. They want to be seen on camera. They want to say to their friends, oh, I met this person. So he did the right thing. He's like, I'm what they're coming here to see. So I'm just going to walk around and be the celebrity top chef and touch the tables. And people are going to walk away and go, that was amazing. I met the guy from the TV show. That's what we're doing. You know, that's how you deliver a great experience.
That was a great experience with Hershey, I got to say.
Hershey, this has been a fantastic experience. We have to have you back on.
Absolutely.
This is, and good luck in Austin.
Thank you.
We need to get out there. That's a good eating town.
Yeah.
You have any early favorites?
I have to be careful here. So we don't, you know what? We do have early favorites. We're down in the Holly neighborhood, which has, I say this to you, Kevin, but Tom, this applies to you as well. We have a spare large guest bedroom. So any of y'all can come along and stay anytime you like. There is a pizza restaurant called Bufalina, which I really love. And it really, it's delicious. The food's really great, and it really amuses me on some of the things that I find hilarious. I'm going to say this disparagingly, but it's really not. It's kind of charming to me. They have two pizzaiolas. They have two young people rolling the pizzas for a pizza oven that holds a maximum. I love that. That really appeals to my sense of humor. Mm,
that's great.
So wait, is this the one on the one in Holly, right below Dawson? Right.
That's right, exactly, on Cesar Chavez. Okay. So listen, if people are listening and you're in Austin, go down to Bufalina. The pizza is delicious. They're super nice people. They're wine geeks, but they don't push it on you. It's a tremendous, tremendous wine list, and I would drop down there. Of course, shameless plug, at the end of February, I would 100% drop into Guild up in the Rosedale neighborhood as well, seafood restaurant. You're going to love it.
Guild.
Ah, bringing some of the magic of your last Pasadena project to Austin.
Correct. You know, there actually is some similarities with the seafood driven thing. That restaurant, Lost at Sea, is a little bit different in style, but yeah.
By the way, I love the food there.
I think Tim does some incredible food.
This is Lost at Sea in Pasadena. It's really been an under the radar place in the 2 years of its existence.
Yeah.
And I'm an enormous fan.
Yeah. I think
that cauliflower flan uni thing that I ordered with the
panna cotta. Yeah, panna cotta. It's unbelievable with the trout roe and the uni.
I've done, to me, there every once in a while, and I did this at Shibumi with the Heritage Fork, I will order an entree or a small dish, a savory dish for dessert, because it's like I just need another. And that was a dish like that.
That's the one. It's so luxurious. And
have you gone farther afield and done the, and we got to go in 1 second, have you been to Lockhart yet, to Lilling?
No, we haven't done it all. We're trying to do
Elegant for sausage.
No, we're trying to do sort of the places in our neighborhood to get a feel first. But we are out and about a lot. They opened their first food hall, their attempt at trying to be a little bit Los Angelino with the food hall. So we were there last night trying out that. Where the standout places, I will say this about Austin. I don't know if this needs to make the podcast necessarily, but Austin is the home of the tremendously over-stylized restaurant.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with the plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
It's just, if you've been here, I know you have, Kevin, you know what I'm talking about. Like with the apron matching the napkin, matching the pen, matching the this, and you're just like, wow, it's really something. Yeah, it's really quite something.
Eric and I need to come to Austin. This is done. This is going to happen in the next 16 months.
Well, please do. I'm telling you, we're set up and ready. And Hockney's ready for you too, you know, so.
Ah, nice. Sir, we will talk very soon.
Lovely chatting with you guys. Good luck. And listen, you're doing real great work with the podcast. So, you know, mad respect. I'm proud of you guys for, you know, I don't know, this doesn't have to make the podcast, but I'm proud of you guys for stepping out from outside the ESPN umbrella.
Kevin, we have a very, very, the most special guest we have had on all season long. You can hear her giggle in the background. That is... Fatima Ali is on the show. Welcome, Fati. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on your show. And I'm very touched that you think that I'm the most special. I hope the other guys don't get too jealous, but they'll understand. It's fine.
We've had Tyler on the show. We've had Chris on the show. We've had Claudette on the show. We've had Richard Blaze. We just had a restaurant consultant who opens restaurants and fixes restaurants for a living on the show just before you. Am I missing anyone else, Kevin, on who's been on the show?
I don't believe so, but we hopefully many more. First of all, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling much better than before. Thank you for asking. I recently had surgery. And my surgeons are fairly confident that they got everything out, which is fantastic. And so I'm looking at hopefully a few more months of treatment, and I'll be all done.
How are you? I know this is an odd question, but how are you staying busy? And also, is there stuff you can do as a chef? Like, is this the time, like, I'm gonna read everything I always wanted to read about the anthropology of food? I mean, how are you staying busy in general? And then also, like, how are you staying busy with respect to, is there stuff you're educating yourself on?
Right. Excellent question. And I try and keep as busy as I can, as long as I'm feeling well. You know, I have a lot of visitors, which is great. So many of the Top Chef crew have come to see me. So that usually takes up a day because, you know, they're such massive personalities in themselves, which is nice. But yes, actually, I have been working on all the things that I've been wanting to do. I've been reading a lot more. I've been doing a lot of recipe testing in my own kitchen, you know, because my plan is that I'd really like to jump into opening up a restaurant as soon as I'm better.
Well, and, you know,
yeah.
This is, this hits close to home. My sister just got over chemotherapy with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she's in remission now, and you are in the thick of it. And I know this is, it's hard to put on a good face in this Instagram world where everyone's having perfect lives and stuff. So this must be.
Tom has a particularly perfect life, I will have you know.
Oh, Kevin, you have no idea, man. So this is a really poignant moment for the show, is that you literally are watching yourself from just, what, 6 months, 7 months ago?
Yeah.
And you are in a different world. This must be just incredibly emotional and incredibly affecting for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like I'm almost watching a different me. And it's nice to have that distraction. You know, it's nice to kind of see myself where I was. And that gives me the goal of where I need to be when I'm better. So it's really interesting to have had, you know, this part of my life recorded. And even now as I'm going through this, you know, there are certain aspects of my life that I'm keeping track of now. So I don't ever forget what this kind of felt like and how easily life can change.
Yeah, where are you on the, oh my God, I can't watch myself on TV spectrum versus, oh, this is fun. I mean, where are you on that to your continuum?
I'm way past the, this is fun. I really enjoy it, although I embarrass myself a lot.
Yes. Kevin and I have both been on TV a whole bunch. I mean, that sounds kind of egotistical, but I still haven't gotten over it. I don't know about you, Kevin.
It's still freaky because it's live. Live TV is crazier than tape. But no, you. It's like I just want to, at the risk of sounding obsequious, You're kind of the adult on the show. Like, there's this wonderful moment in the beginning of this episode that we just watched, Restaurant Wars, where they're kind of recapping the previous week, and you know, Tanya's elimination. And after all the rancor, it's sort of like the adult in the room says, she was eliminated because it was an exceedingly hard challenge, and I'm going to miss the hell out of her, and that was that, right? Rather than kind of perpetuate sort of the conflicts that were going on, you come in there and you basically kind of in the classiest, most succinct way say, she was eliminated because this is really hard, which it is.
Right.
Like, Top Chef is really difficult. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, that's what I didn't want people to forget. Like, people who are watching, I didn't want them to just, you know, the last impressions, I understand, are very important, but I wanted people to understand that what we do is incredibly hard. Mm. And, you know, you can't forget that in all the personalities and in all the drama that happens. There's a lot of things that everyone doesn't get to see behind the scenes too, but it's grueling. It's a very grueling process. And if, you know, that's the name of the game, someone goes home every single week. There is no changing that. Go ahead.
Sorry to cut you off there. I just had to ask, what does Padma mean to you?
Of course you have to ask that. You know, she's actually an incredibly wonderful, incredibly humble, like very down-to-earth, very real person, you know. And I can say that it's like when I've needed friends around the most, like she stepped up to the plate without me ever asking. It's something that she did of her own accord, and that, to me, that's something that's really special. And now we're very close friends, and I value that friendship immensely.
When you made that first dish and she gave you the seal of approval and the endorsement, how nervous were you before Padma first ate your food?
I was a big nervous wreck, I think, throughout the whole thing. you know, it was really wonderful to be able to feed someone that you've grown up watching on TV and that you've admired. and I got to do that with her, and you know, and the fact that she actually liked my food made it all the more real, you know, made it all the more palpable for me. It reinforced the reason why I wanted to be there and why I wanted to win. It was very cool.
I want to ask you a kind of restaurant wars. It was the first bottom finish for you. And I realize this is months later and we're acting as if this is like the middle of the NBA season or something. So you're right. One question I did have for you is working. It dawned on me, is there a major advantage of the judges coming earlier or in the night rather than later? Or does it like it dawned on me that on that particular challenge, like when they walk in that restaurant is a major, major has a major influence on just how the front of the house.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So like, I mean, coming second is tougher or easier. What do you think?
I think it's more challenging having them come to your restaurant in the thick of things. And therefore in the second half,
Agreed.
Because what you have to understand is that a lot of your diners will want to stick around and be on TV in the background and watch the judges do the judging. And so they won't want to budge. You know, because it's much easier to turn tables in the first half because people will leave when the judges do. Because for them, then it's over. They don't want to stick around. You know, they're happy to keep moving. Whereas, you know, in the second half, I had so many of my diners from my first push just want to stick around, and like refuse to leave even though checks were dropped. And, you know, people were asked nicely. It's like, all right, I hope you had a wonderful time at a restaurant, but it's time for you to, like, leave now because I have more people I need to see.
So when you got the assignment, I can't remember how it went down. You said you could do either executive chef or front of house. Yeah. Did you secretly want to do executive chef and then you got the front of house, or how did that go down?
You know, I wanted to be a team player first and foremost because Restaurant Wars is a team challenge. And for me, it's very, very important to look at the bigger picture than just what I wanted to do. Having said that, you know, I would have loved to do the first Pakistani restaurant ever on Restaurant Wars. That would have been awesome. If I was given the executive chef role, I would have pushed for that 100%. I would have like made it so that everyone was comfortable enough to try and do that with me, you know.
Yeah.
And I would have taken complete onus of it too.
Yes,
if they didn't like the food, then hey, send me home. But I would rather go home cooking Pakistani food than anything else.
Yeah, I mean that was my critique of the commonplace thing, and I think at some point, you know, Mustache Joe said, you know, that's not specific enough. And I actually think going with Pakistani or going with soul food, if Chris were going to be kind of the culinary luminary of the project, for that matter, going with Jaliscan food, if it were Claudette, it was because stylistically you guys are all so different that you needed to define the common thread, and that probably should have been a specific cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. If there are any Top Chef hopefuls for next season, that's the one thing that I would say. Is that for Restaurant Wars, you have to really focus in on your concept, because it doesn't matter, you know, how beautiful your restaurant looks or how wonderful your plates look or how good the food is. If your concept isn't good, forget about it.
I'll do a couple minutes on Pakistani food because I'm just always interested sort of in regional, the smaller regional distinctions. And obviously the colonial history of that part of the world is sort of a story of arbitrary borders. And, you know, like even the place I go to in Lawndale, California, called Al Noor, which is Indo-Pakistani.
Right.
And I mean, so when you open what is going to be redefined, you know, modern Pakistani cuisine, and that gets open, like what is it? Like, can you situate it for me kind of on the culinary map and sort of what influences are there or not there, say, from, you know, obviously, you know, whether it's Bengali or Tamil, or I mean, what are the distinctions there, just so I'm more educated?
Right. I mean, I get this question all the time. What's the difference between Indian and Pakistani food? You know, and I think the easiest way for me to explain it is that Pakistani food on the spectrum is a lot less sweet, and there's a lot more emphasis on meat than there is vegetarianism. You'll be hard pressed to find a vegetarian Pakistani. I mean, maybe millennials, but you know, talking about old school Pakistani.
Wait, we're both millennials, Fonzie. You just threw some shade at
Whereas I'm not.
I just threw some shade on my own people. Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, like true Pakistanis, you'll never, you know, they just wouldn't be vegetarian because there's so much emphasis on meat in our culture. And a lot of that has to do with barbecue and just like the love and the joy for barbecued meats, like mutton, goat, you know, chicken, beef, you know, you name it, we have it. And
Am I correct in that one of the reasons for that also is these traditions are informed by religion?
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, like we know from the Abrahamic religions, whether it's Judaism or Islam or Christianity, that sort of like meat has a different place than it does in a Hindu tradition.
Right, absolutely. And going back to religion, I mean, Pakistan was the first country to be founded on the basis of religion, the second being Israel. And it's because there's absolutely no pork product in Pakistan. And that was the main source of contention, right? Was that we wanted to differentiate ourselves from India because of religious differences. And so a lot of that has to do with our food and our culture. And so when you go to India, you'll get a pork vindaloo. And then in some regions, it'll just be vegetarianism because of Hinduism. And when you go to Pakistan, because of the identity being predominantly Muslim, you'll find that our food actually goes back into the Mughal dynasty, which is when Muslim rulers were in that area. And that was when, like, true Mughlai cuisine was just taking root, was just forming. And that's where a lot of our heritage comes from.
Also, in terms of sweetness, you're not in the tropics for the most part. I mean, maybe down near Karachi is close, but I mean, am I correct that, I mean, most, you're talking about food that's going to feel like it's from a mountain country versus a tropical one.
We have a variety of topographies in Pakistan as well.
Right, because you are on the coast. Like Karachi is a...
Yeah, absolutely. Karachi is a coastal city, which is very different from the food that you're going to get up north in the mountains where it snows, you know? So it's like, it's really indigenous to the kind of land that you live in Pakistan as well.
Fatih, I love this religious talk and educating me and all this stuff and this highbrow conversation here. But
let's get back to the gospel.
I just really got to know, can you do a reality show where you just cook in the snow outside in Denver?
Oh, just always in front of
Just always outside in the snow, in the elements. Can we do that? Can we make that happen?
I mean, I would be miserable as all hell, as you most likely have seen, but I can certainly make it entertaining.
how hard was that episode for you when they were like, "Oh, we're going to be outside"? And
oh my god!
Okay,
I was right.
So you're not, and you're also likewise mornings snow.
Yeah.
You're not a good deprivation challenge kind of participant. You did fine in the breakfast challenge. I loved your candy turkey.
Thank you.
I didn't taste it.
Yeah, I rise to the occasion, but that won't mean I won't. I bitch the entire time, but I do my best.
I always like to ask a series of kind of Rorschach questions to chefs. One is, if you were president of the United States, who's your White House chef?
Oh my God. Joseph Flam.
I mean, could be someone on the show, someone not on the show.
Well, can we just tell Fatih that we had a restaurant consultant who's opened like two dozen restaurants or fixed up two dozen restaurants on the show just before you. And I asked him, after watching this season, what chef would you want to hire to be the face of the restaurant? And he picked Joe Flam. I love Joe Flam. He's got some of the funniest lines. He seems like just the genuinely nice dude that I would want to grab beers with after a basketball game or whatever it is. But that kind of surprised. Like, I feel like Joe Flam has done an amazing season. He's an amazing guy. But he picked Joe Flam as the guy he would want to, you know, be the head chef for his restaurant. You've lived with the guy. You know him better than any of us. He's awesome.
Yeah, he really is. He's such a gem of a human being. He is, you know, one of the most genuine, generous people I've ever met. And he's just so down to earth and simple. Like, he is who he is. Like, there are no bones about it. Like, Joe is Joe. And I think that's what draws people to him. And that's what people see when they watch, too. I say there are glimpses of genius in Joe. You know, and the thing is that I think you guys will get to see that hopefully soon. because, yeah, you know, I know he's been kind of a sleeper on the show.
I've identified him. I mean, I think he was the pick I got after you in my fantasy draft.
Yes, I think I remember that.
all right, here's a question I like. Ingredient you love to use, but it's such a pain in the ass. And if it weren't, you'd use it more. Like for me, fava beans.
Oh, yeah, sure. But they smell like feet. Oh.
Like they're kind of the perfect. What's yours? What is your ingredient? Oh, man, I really love that, but it is such a pain in the ass.
I think for me, that would probably be tamarind. You know, it's such a unique and pungent flavor, and I love it for sweet and savory. But just processing it is a pain, like really good quality tamarind, getting the pods out. And then also, it's very easy for that to overpower a dish completely. You know, I've had like tamarind glazed ribs, and they're absolutely terrible. You know? But then I've had a cocktail with tamarind in it, and it's divine. So...
Country you'd like to live in for 18 months, totally immersively, learn the culinary origins and traditions.
Spain. Yeah, 100%. I went there when I was at the Culinary Institute of America. They took us for a 3-week tour, and I fell in love with it. San Sebastian is one of the most incredible places on earth. The restaurant scene is so cutting edge and so unique that I would absolutely love 18 months in Spain.
Question. Bears, yes. The bears are annoying. Bears are, you feel part of the bears. You're the baby bear. Is it overplayed on TV? What is the bear dynamic?
I still enjoy the bears. I don't think it's annoying. Bears, I think it's very cute because I love them all individually very much. It is a little bit overplayed on TV, though.
Okay.
It's nonstop bears, which is silly because it wasn't that intense when we were all. I mean, it was kind of intense. That was just Bruce, but it wasn't as intense.
But you weren't on the bear team on Restaurant Wars. You must have been a little bummed out about that.
Yeah, I was a little bit bummed, but, you know, that's just how the picks go.
Kevin, do you want to ask the really tough question about your conspiracy theory here?
Oh, yeah, tell me.
All right. Did y'all set Claudette up? I mean, and here's what I mean. I don't mean it was a malicious, like, I'm talking about the idea that, look, there's a win-win associated with this. I mean, you put yourself a little bit in a moment of vulnerability because by virtue of the fact that if the front of the house is a mess and the team loses, you are a favorite to go home. But in terms of the kitchen structure, it dawns on me that Chris playing the, hey, and Joe Stash as well playing the, hey, you know what? I'm just a wine cook. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to execute 2 or 3 dishes really well. And that way, if we win, great. If Claudette is the winner, she takes home the prize as executive chef, wonderful. But if she loses, the truth is I'm not going to go home for 2 or 3 good dishes when I know I can execute them, and rarely does the line chef or the non-2 principal players on a Restaurant Wars team ever go home. And as long as you execute your dishes reasonably well. Therefore, Claudette's sort of left with the most vulnerable position, with 2 people working under who damn well know they're probably not going to go home.
Yeah, that's a very interesting theory you have there. You're a smart guy, huh?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, all right. Yes. So there we go.
Yes.
So here's the thing. It's not that we didn't discuss. We didn't discuss this exact thing happening. We discussed a little bit, but it wasn't intentional in terms of Chris setting anyone up for failure. We wanted to win. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way we wanted to be on the bottom, but. You know, yeah,
I don't think it seems so much set up for failure as it's a win-win, right? Like if you guys did it out of the park, then great. That's wonderful. Yeah. And happy to share that success with anybody on the team.
This is such a prisoner's dilemma. I love it.
However, if it so happens we don't are so successful, then we have a little bit of an out.
The only thing is that you know, the judges are incredibly temperamental also, and you never really know who's going home. Like they could have easily switched on Chris and been like, you know what, Chris? Go home.
Can you also affirm my gay man's crush of Gail Simmons?
Yes, 100%.
Is she awesome?
She's phenomenal. She's stunning.
I want to have dinner with Gail.
Somewhere
very Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. She has such a wonderful aura. Like, I would love to have 5 cocktails with Gail. Oh, my God.
I want to go to Innaka with Gail Simmons.
Oh, my God. Yes, yes,
and drink
yes.
Drink sake and have that dinner.
I just heard a story about that restaurant.
Oh, tell me your story about Innaka. Please.
I know someone in Los Angeles, a very good friend of my cousin's who works for the LA Times, who is obsessed with Chef's Table. Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So she was on there. She saw her episode, actually goes to this, nondescript sushi joint in Koreatown, finds out that that's her partner's dad's place, freaks out, mentions it. Gets kind of like the cold shoulder from everyone who works there, gets confused, goes to the restaurant for their reservation to Naka, and then tells them the story, and then they laugh. And so it's like this awkward, interesting dynamic of this father-daughter and her partner and the Japanese culture. And now I'm dying to go and eat at this restaurant because they also said that it was one of the best best experiences of their lives.
Yeah, it's very traditional kaiseki, but it is just beautiful and delicate and clean and serene and all the things you'd want a modern, restaurant. Almost, it sounds like you're going to Ryokan or something. It's kind of the perfect restaurant. It's impossible to get a table. I've been once, been wanting to go again, but never think of it in time, and you have to book that stuff far out.
Oh yeah.
I want to go there with Gail Simmons. This is what I want for my birthday.
Well, you guys can name drop all you want, but I just really need to get back to the show here and ask a very superficial question. Did you discuss with Chris before he jumped on the grenade at the judges' table, it was my fault, I'm going to own this. Did you discuss that, hey, you say that, Chris, that you're this noble guy and that I'm going to own this, and then you know what? I'm going to save you.
Oh, is that no? We did not do that.
But you felt compelled to like stand up for Chris there, yeah?
Yeah, because he was just being so irritating and silly. Like, I was just not having it. I was like, this is the reason why Chris is doing this. Please don't listen to him. Like, that's really what I wanted to say, And I was getting upset with him because he decided that he wanted to be this martyr, because that's just who Chris is. Like, he feels so deeply for everything. And I thought that it wasn't necessary. It was like, listen, like if Claudette didn't step up to be the executive chef that she was supposed to be, then that's on her. Just like if the service wasn't where it needed to be, and that was the defining reason why we lost Restaurant Wars, then I was the one who was going to go home. If his pork dish was so horrifically bad that that's the reason why we were at the bottom, then yeah, sure, then pick on Chris. But otherwise, there was no reason for him to pretend like he was the restaurant owner just because he drew the knife first.
Yeah, there's a little bit of arbitrariness in there. And I wanted to ask you, it seemed like you made a choice based on the viewing of the episode. And maybe this is different than the actual reality of the situation. But it seemed like when you were front of house, you had a choice. I'm going to tend to the servers or I'm going to tend to the people. If the servers don't go well, this whole thing's going down. But if I don't get to the people, at least they get their food. At least it's timely. Did you have that in your head of like, I need to go that side or that side?
I was trying to look at the bigger picture as well, and I could only do so much, because the servers are completely brand new. So I did spend a little bit more time than I wish I had just trying to teach them and fixing their mistakes. Having said that, we had all high tops on our side, which is completely different than Conifer, right? Because they had regular tables.
Oh. Yeah, and Tom was not happy about it, apparently.
Right. And my theory is that it was also a lot easier to see someone like Joe Flam walking from table to table than it is like someone like me.
Wait, so there's some physics
here involved.
Walking
from table to table. Yes.
Wow.
I think so. And maybe that's just me like refusing to believe that I did such a god-awful job.
Because you did say I'm surprised you didn't see me do that.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, so now, I love this little conspiracy theory here.
My
that
theory
they were set
is
up to succeed because he's tall, big, and he doesn't have high tops.
And he doesn't have high tops. And I'm, like this cute little thing running from table to table. And, you could easily miss me in the sea of diners.
Wow.
I believe you.
Thank you.
I believe you.
That's all I need. I just needed that affirmation.
Best thing you tasted all season that wasn't yours?
So this is a tough question because she has to think.
There was some really, really pretty amazing food. Some pretty bad food too, I'm not going to lie. Some pretty amazing food too. I think I really like Brother's paella dish that he did. That was really flavorful for the 30 minutes we had. It was super impressive. Joe Snapper, the very first day.
Oh, yeah.
I still remember. That was absolutely delicious.
The hangover. You were part of the hangover cure, right?
I was, yeah.
Was that a fun one, the food truck episode? I know that you've had a few drinks in your day, so you know what that feels like.
Oh, yeah. I love that one. That was a pretty solid win for us. Because I was one of the only ones who had actually worked on a food truck, and so I was helping boys navigate through that one, and that was a lot of fun. There were so many really fantastic challenges, honestly. I'm like not in it now, so I can enjoy watching it, being like, look at these idiots running around.
is there any sort of psychological, I don't want to say warfare, I mean, warfare is a terrible metaphor. Are there any psyching out in the kitchen in terms of the sheer competitiveness and when it's actually your mid-challenge?
Well, like when Claudette, for example, when Claudette isn't tasting the food as the executive chef before it goes out, are you looking at that being like, all right, well, you go do that? Or are you like, you know what? I want to be the good teammate and say, hey, Claudette, you should really be doing this because it'll make our food better, making sure it tastes good, and you'll probably fare better at the judges' table.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you have to, because the thing is that you don't want to be in the bottom. You don't want to be on the losing team no matter what. It doesn't matter whether you stand out. If you're on the winning team, you're safe. You're good for another episode, right? But if you're in the bottom, there's a chance you're going home. And so I feel like to be smart enough to understand how that works, how this competition works, you have to be that kind of team player. You have to stand up and say something. You know, if I had been in the kitchen enough and I had seen Claudette, you know, doing that, I would have said something. But I was in and out. Just taking care of my dining room, you know, just like I would expect one of my teammates, if they had come to the front and they had seen that I wasn't doing something that I should be doing, I would want them to say something to me to make sure that we were in the top. But when it's individual challenges, I think it's very different. I think you psych yourself out more than anybody else, you know, trying to do anything to you.
Yeah, Tyler said, fuck quick fires.
Yeah, they're so nerve-wracking. There's no time.
That's the stuff that really, I mean, I said at the beginning of the show, we started recording a few months ago, just that, like, I sort of watch you guys the way I watch LeBron James. Like, I cook a lot at home, and I've gotten to be a good intermediate cook that friends can come to dinner, and, you know, I don't embarrass myself and, you know, serve some nice food, but that's the extent of it. I'm an amateur home chef, and right. I watch all of y'all, and it is just for the sheer creativity. Like, I'm actually realizing that I've basically been performing recipes for my whole life. The fact that you guys can go into a situation with a ticking time bomb, no thought whatsoever before an ingredient was basically just presented to you, and you're told go. Like, I can't even get, like, there's a part of me that still doesn't believe the show's real, even though I go to restaurants every day almost and know that, yes, they're firing a meal and I'm getting a plate in 20 minutes, like, clearly. But, like, I just can't even conceive of being competent and intuitive enough to be able to pull the shit you guys pull on what for me is a weekly basis when I'm watching the show.
Right. I think some of us are surprised as well, honestly. I think some of us surprised, you know, looking back at it now, it's pretty incredible the kind of creativity that everybody has. It's like you go into, you know, fight or flight. So it's either you run or you stick to your guns and you cook your ass off and you try and do your absolute best every single time. Because that's why you're here. Because you give up so much to be there, honestly. You have to make it worthwhile.
real quick.
A question about
Tom, go ahead, Kevin. Because I'm now just mooching off knowledge. It's like I just want to be a better knife skills person. Like Fati, the burden in my life right now is I want it to take a lot less time to finally chop an onion.
Sure.
But like I'm also a how does a home knife chef improve? Like, is there like workout videos? Or seriously, if I don't want to go to a culinary school and I want to learn how to do what you guys, like when I'm watching and like, why can't I cut an onion that efficiently? Like it takes me forever to chop an onion. Like I'm getting better, but like
sharper knife.
I bought one in Japan. It's fantastic. I have to get the tip repaired.
Oh, I have no doubt. Yeah. But about his knife. Like, you know, he's got a good knife. I can tell just by the way he speaks about his dinner parties.
Yes.
But how am I getting better? Like, give me the regimen. Like
practice.
But you lose like a finger if you like. It's kind of a weird thing to practice.
It goes slow, but like don't go fast. Like, you know, that's like you can't right off the gate go fast, and then you will end up losing a digit. You have to go slow, and you have to practice.
Just even the phrase "losing a digit" is terrible.
I mean, if you're talking about, you know, the way some of us slice an onion, that's because we have been slicing onions for French onion soup in our restaurant, you know, in a restaurant that we've worked for years.
So it's reps. I have to do 10,000 hours of French onion soup.
Absolutely. And then I'll get it. That's the way I learned. That's the way I learned the hard way.
There's if we told progress. Fati to eat a meal and then write a blog post about it in 20 minutes, she might not be able to do that in the same way that I wouldn't be able to perform a quick fire, right?
No, I could do that.
Oh, damn it. She's so talented.
See, exactly. She could do our jobs. I'm sorry, Tom. I interrupted the question. Bit.
Yeah, I wanted to know, how does the sequencing happen? You do the quick fire happens, and then is there a break and you have to do the confessional? How does that work, the camera work there? Are you not allowed to talk about that?
Well, you know, it doesn't really matter how it works because it doesn't affect what you see on camera anyway. Sometimes they do that and sometimes they don't.
That was such a crisp move right there that you just did. You just absolved responsibility there. You just sidestepped.
But it's not important. Like, I know you guys want to know just for the sake of knowing, but it actually, you know, it makes no difference.
You guys do such a good job of staying in the present tense. That's what's so admirable.
Well, that's practice, my friend.
Yes.
That's why you don't see most of our first interviews. Because they don't show them because we were so bad at them.
We're now at the recommendation part of the show. So I'm actually going to New York the fourth weekend in March, maybe. I forget.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
All right. I want to book a table Saturday night in Brooklyn. Give me three options.
In Brooklyn?
And by the way, nothing stuffy, but just, you know, like, but it's also Saturday night because that's just the night I happen to have.
You have enough time to try and get a table at Olmsted.
Okay.
Go there for sure. Lilia's for pasta. That's Missy Robbins' place. Absolutely phenomenal. And then, you know,
Butterfunk Kitchen.
Yeah, go see Chris at Butterfunk Kitchen. Exactly.
Yeah, playing this very well. I'm going to Chicago on Wednesday, and I'm not going to make Spiaggi. I'm really upset about it. I want to say hi to Joe though.
Yeah.
So if you have any other a Charlotte lunch recommendation, maybe I can do that. But
I have no idea. I've never been to Chicago. Mm. I have to. Joe's gonna fly me out for a Cubs game.
Oh yes, yes. Have you ever been to Wrigley Field?
I've never been. No.
Oh well, that's a dumb question. You just said you've never been to Chicago.
Yeah, that was kind of dumb, but it's okay.
Have you seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off though?
I have.
Yes. All right. So you kind of been to a Cubs game because you've seen that movie.
Because I've seen that movie. Is that how it works? Okay.
Yeah. I've actually been to the house where they drive the car off the second floor.
Oh.
I've been to that house. It's in, I think it's in Lake Forest outside of Chicago. My sister went to college there. So.
Very cool.
What else, Fati? What else? Can you tell us anything about your life that you want to plug?
You know, honestly, I just want to thank everyone that's been sending me so many messages. I have received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages. I can't keep track of everyone, but I just want to thank everyone that has taken the time out to send me something sweet while I'm going through my cancer treatment. And I just want to say that it has meant so much to me to know that I have so many supporters out there. And hopefully it translates to fan favorite. Which voting should happen in February. Just putting it out there. Oh, yes.
Now that is the plug that we were looking for, is I want to be the fan favorite.
I've got you in fan favorite pool. Yeah.
Thank you.
If I'm going to do a draft, I mean, we're going to be fighting over that number one pick, Kevin.
I think it's we didn't even factor that in. That, you know what? We should have factored in an extra few points for – we can't do it retroactively. I appreciate that, Tom. But next season. Yeah. We should definitely – you should get some points for fan favorite. You really should.
You should definitely get some points for fan favorite.
Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. I love listening to you guys. And I hope your viewership – keeps increasing because you are so charming, both of you.
It's such a fun show.
Thank you so much, Fati. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and best of luck the rest of your treatment. And please don't hesitate to reach out if you want to be on the show again. We love having you on.
Oh, for sure. Done. Thank you so much to both of you.
Talk to you soon. This is Pack Your Knives.